Welcome to The Truth in His Art, your source for conversations at the intersection of arts, culture, and community. A space for real conversations where people, well, sound like people. I am your host, Rob Lee. Thank you for tuning in, sharing, and subscribing this podcast. Continue to do so. Help us out. This episode is brought to you by AwesomeCon. That is Washington, D.C.'s Comic-Con. I'll be there. Will you? Today, it is my pleasure to welcome my next guest, an influential voice in speculative fiction, celebrated for her thought-provoking novels that weave together themes of identity, memory, and social justice. Please welcome Bethany C. Morrow. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you for making the time. And, you know, we were chatting a little bit beforehand, so I'm going to like compartmentalize that a little bit. I'll say, yeah, so back to the movie conversation we were having.
Right.
But for starters, one of the things that I aim for in this podcast is giving folks the, you know, space to share who they are authentically. So I did the, you know, sort of cut and paste online amalgamation of a bio. But for you, could you share who you are, you know, introduce yourself in your own words before we get into the deeper conversation?
That is hilariously difficult. And that is probably going to be one of the most, like, that's going to be one of the most frustrating questions, only because as authors, and here's something that I think people genuinely don't understand, even if they're my age. I'm 42 years old and internet started in earnest when I was in high school. And we learned pretty quick, you don't put your whole self online, right? So, I mean, at first we're meeting people online. I mean, I'm going to the mall to meet people that I've only talked to in chat rooms. So let's not even talk about that terror. But like, once the gravity begins to descend upon us of what this is and what this allows, we don't put our whole self online. So there are a lot of people who I think, because I, like a lot of people my generation, know how to seem whole on social media, are like, I know exactly who this person is. I mean, unfortunately, I've had people tell me that they know exactly who I am. And I'm like, beloved, but you don't. And it's for my benefit that you don't. It's for my safety that you don't. So I will tell you probably some similar stuff that you have seen on social media. I am married. I have a son at Howard University that I'm very proud of. He's a classical voice major. I'm a mama. I raised him in Montreal, Quebec. We're both, I'll say, I'm from California. He was born in California. Sorry. Sorry, baby. Like I said, I think I said I'm a quad roller skater. I'm looking at my skates right now, so I'm making sure I bring that back. I mentioned to you, I am a Planet of the Apes stan. I love speculative literary is kind of my home. Novella is what I consider to be a perfect format. I think there are a lot of people out here who think they're novelists because they don't realize that everything doesn't have to be a novel, and you don't have to write novels to be an author. So I like to give intimate tidbits that help you know something about me and feel a connection to me without actually telling people all of my business.
I love it. And the writer thing is coming through heavy, which I appreciate. It. Right. You know, like I'm 39. I just turned 39. So I definitely, mm-hmm. I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it. And it's, you know, I encounter it sometimes. Like I'm really like big. I take up a lot of space. Like I'm tall. And, you know, with it, people will see me from like a distance and say, oh, beyond the horizon, there goes Rob O'Hara. And it's one of those things where, and I don't know, maybe because I saw like the Cillian Murphy thing recently when he's talking about he prefers those real connections, so he doesn't touches mm-hmm. with people anymore.
Yeah,
I feel that, and yeah. I want to have that deeper connection because as I said, you know, before we got started, I was like, I'll probably see you at the con.
Yes.
And I'm going to make it my business to see you at the con because we're right. exchanging and sharing in this moment, and. A lot of times folks don't see that. It's like, oh, I'm just going through the doldrums. It's like, I'm not doing the superficial conversation.
Right.
I'm going to ask you questions you've asked before, but I might ask them differently but we're connecting. And that's yeah. the sort of the intent and the goal. So to your point around like, I can't put all of my stuff out there.
Right.
I wouldn't be able to answer that question myself. It's like, yeah, I'm Rob X. It's like, that's not at all.
there's part of me that I'm, and as an author, I mean, what people should understand is I am sharing the most authentic part of myself because I'm an author and because I'm a writer and because my writing interrogates the American imagination and sometimes indicts the American imagination. And it's a cultural contribution. And I understand that as somebody whose degree was in sociology. This is not entertainment is entertainment and entertainment is wonderful, but it's not just entertainment. So I'm very much putting myself in this context of like, I understand my place and my role in this society as an artist, and I'm willingly doing it. So just because you don't know the details of the minutiae of my life does not mean that you don't know, hopefully, my heart and hopefully my character. But in terms of what street I live on and stuff, beloved, like, people really want to know these things. And I'm like, no.
Oh, I'm on Mind Your Business Avenue. But yeah, you're right. And, you know, and I'm going to go into this next question because I'm very curious of where sort of the journey begins in fiction, in writing, and sort of like, what was that like? But the one thing I definitely want to throw out there is, yeah, I totally relate. I totally get it. When you're sharing doing this, right? Like, It's almost like the spoon feeding of things. And, you know, like I was listening to interviews with like Sam Esmail. He's like, everybody wants to know something. He's like, I can't see what the thing is. And I apply that to even doing this. Like folks will ask me, can you spoon feed? Who the people that you talk to and why are you talking to them? Who is the audience? And somewhat defensively, I say, do I find them interesting? That's the audience.
Right.
Those are the people I want to talk to. Those are the conversations. And to, you know, dog pilot, if you will. It's, you know, you can't fake authenticity. You can't fake like interest. It's hard to fake interest. And
impossible for some of us.
So that's that. And you know, if I'm like, I don't really care about this work, that's a good interview, but I don't really care about this work, it's gonna come. And the people that I really like, you know, they don't really need to know about me and me saying like, hey, I like black artists, I like fiction, I like things.
Yeah.
You can hear it in the interviews. You can hear it in sort of the folks that come on. So for you, where did the journey start? Like, was there, you know, looking back, was there something like when you were like a young person, like super young, like you were reading and it kind of laid the foundation, or even watching it kind of laid some of those foundations, some of those, even maybe even the mortar of the foundation for you? Or where does the story start for you?
What's really interesting about this is like, this is a very, so we get trapped in sort of narrative styles and conventions, even when we don't know it. And for good reason. Okay. I'm not trying to talk down to anybody. As a student of sociology, we do this for a reason. It simplifies the world around us. It allows us to quickly make sense of things and sort of quickly categorize things. But because of that, we'll sometimes approach artists of any kind and ask them like, where did it start, as though there was a start. And the thing for me is that I can't answer that question because it's an incorrect framework for me. Nothing started, it always was. And I think it conveys this sort of assumption that non-artists usually have, and that's who we're usually making these interviews for, the listeners, typically somebody who enjoys and has an interest, many of them will be artists, but a lot of them won't be. And so it'll make sense to them to say, where did this start? Because you start going to school at some point, you start a hobby at some point. So that makes a lot of sense to people. But for me, that kind of suggests a sort of intentionality in beginning something, where for some of us, it was an inevitability. It was simply, this is who I've always been. This is what I've always done. Because not everybody waits until someone introduces the concept of writing something down. Some of us were writing stuff down and then somebody told us what we were doing. So I remember it couldn't have been past second grade. We had free write. And we would get these, I just love the appearance of them. It was odd dimensions of these colored spiral notebooks. And we would get one. And I think my first one was probably orange or yellow. I have a memory of it being orange or yellow. You know, they were primary colored notebooks. And our teacher would give them to us during Free Write. And then I was like, what happens when I fill this up? Nobody else filled them up, apparently. So I kept getting new ones, which is where I can't completely remember what color my first one was, but I was the only person actually writing during Free Write, apparently. Everybody else was allowed. Eventually it was like, okay, read quietly. Okay, play that, like that tabletop football, you know, how we used to fold the paper. Yeah, right. Play that quietly. Okay. Okay. Right. Exactly. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, everybody was given all of these little concessions, like, okay, well, as long as it's quiet, just the point for the teacher was leave me alone. So I kept getting, there were plenty of these books to receive because nobody was actually using them. And I was writing stories in them. And now at the time, I, you know, like a lot of artists, I was a complete plagiarist. I was, but because I'm a Black girl, wasn't quite plagiarism. It was more of a remix because I was taking stories that I liked that I was completely absent from. Mm-hmm. And I was writing myself as the main character of those stories. This is early, early elementary school. And I remember my teacher, taping one of my short stories to the top of my desk. And when my parents came for back to school night, you know, very excitedly being like, this is what she does during her free time. And her thinking that my parents not having a big reaction was like, oh, these black parents, like, not encouraging. And I was like, ma'am, you are not the first person to be forced to listen to my short stories. Like, these people are well aware of what I've been doing. So I don't, you know what I mean? This is like if you asked a kid, like, when was the first time you went to recess? Like, I don't know. It was something that I always did, and it seemed completely natural to me. Riding bikes and reading and making video book reports and all of that stuff is just normal stuff to me that I was doing the entire time. And I honestly, until junior high, didn't know that it was there was any difficulty or any intentionality necessary in being an author. I thought I already was. Like, I was already, I'm like, what? I'm doing it.
No, thank you. Wow. Because here's the thing. Like, you touch on that. It makes me think of sort of these moments or what have you. But, you know, you think of, like, this is the moment where this began the construct idea, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's just like, no, there's other stuff even before that. Like, right. I sit there and make up stories of movies I've never seen because I wanted people to be interested in what I had to say.
Exactly.
And I'm like, I've never seen this movie, actually. And it was like Guyver from 1992 or whatever. And, you know, but when I got to this sort of point of doing this, I can remember sort of when a certain phase of it happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can go back to like high school and thinking of pulling out the recorder and just, you know how people would do the superlatives, end of the year, yearbook stuff. Yeah. I would, because I was a troll, I was a little bit of a heel. I would say, most of y'all are not going to be here next year. So can you say what your story in this microphone, since you're not going to be able to, you know, stay because your grades are trash? Oh, that was the energy I was on.
That is hilarious because I had a voice recorder. Again, I'm a historian. I mean, before I'm an author, I'm all of these other documenter type of identities, because I was a journaler since I was 8 years old. I remember, I have my first journal. I have all of my journals, but don't worry, they will be burned. So if any of you come looking for them, not today, Satan. So I was journaling. My family is very big into taking pictures, which is why, I mean, I just had somebody come to my house and be like, I've never been in a house with this many pictures on the wall. And I'm like, look, that's I came by very honestly. My family has always been like that. You take pictures of moments and of people that you enjoy and you put them up. So I've always been recording, and I think of fiction very much the same way, partially recording myself and partially recording the society that I'm observing, particularly the parts of it that they think they're hiding. But I had a voice recorder in junior high, and I really just, it was just, I was always recording my friends. There was no point to it. Sometimes it obviously got crass and ridiculous because I mean, I've always had the kind of I feel like I've always had a little bit of a either 12-year-old boy or just like stoner kind of sense of humor. It's ridiculous. And if I had to listen to it back, which we always did on double speed, it would be a lot. It would be cringe. But I love that sort of thing. And I guess that's how people knew me, because what was strange to me is nobody else was doing it.
Yeah.
So I brought a voice recorder every day because I'm like, who is collecting like these moments? Why is nobody collecting these moments? I don't know. So that is amazing to hear that you shared in that. And then I went on to be in a newspaper in high school, was the senior editor of the newspaper and stuff. Anytime there's a chance to record the moment that I'm living in, the society, the culture that I'm living in, I've always been about it.
That's great. And that's really, you know, sort of what I aim for in doing this. Like I've, you know, and before I move into this next question, you know, I've heard the thing of, oh, you're an anthropologist. I was like, you're an archivist. You're a documentarian. it's just like, it's naturally there. And I think it's something about it. You used to have this question about sort of that childlike wonder. And I think that's what we're kind of poking at of, you know, when you just do it to do it, it's just there. You're not thinking about it in that way. And I find when other folks start anointing things, it's like, you're the person writing a Wikipedia page, not me.
Right.
I'm just doing the thing.
Ask me how many times I've been to my Wikipedia page.
I've been there a lot, but no.
Listen, the only thing I know is the one time that I went, which somebody, I think the person who made it sort of just like nudged me to be like, oh, I made your Wikipedia page. And I was like, well, this is woefully incomplete and some of it inaccurate. But I didn't say a word because I'm like, that's none of my business. It's none of my business.
What you guys are doing.
Right.
So I want to ask this before I start asking about specific works. Is there a conversation? It kind of is a good piggyback. Is there a conversation, a book, or a film that significantly impacted like your perspective on creative work, like macroly speaking? Like, you know, like when I do this, I go through maybe old interviews because you know we're all plagiarists, right? I go through all interviews, you know, these old interviews with people that I was like, oh, I like the way that you do this. Like, I used to have like James Lipton questions. Like, I used to have one. What's your favorite curse word? I used to get a rapid fire question. And it's literally something I lifted from elsewhere. And the perspective was getting into the thinking, or even Austin Kleon books or Rafi Perez books of, I want to get into the thinking, not the typical. So tell me about your work. I want to know the thinking that goes into the work. And reading some of those books gave me perspective, that gave me sort of acknowledgement that perspective was worthwhile. So was there a book or a conversation maybe that you had or some form of media that kind of gave you like that impacted your perspective or kind of like said, hey, you know what? You should be doing this. This is a good idea to kind of keep going and going in this direction.
Again, it was inevitable. So nothing had to inspire me to do it and nothing was going to stop me from doing it. But in terms of moments that I remember thinking, oh, so yeah, somebody is doing this. Because the thing with being a Black artist, number one, people, in order to hide white supremacy and to hide anti-Blackness, are perfectly willing to dub you or crown you the first or the only or whatever. And unfortunately, a lot of us have gotten into the habit of accepting those titles and accepting that designation, which doesn't make sense for people who care about our ancestry, doesn't make sense for people who care about the people who came before us and what it costs for them to come before us. Yeah. I know Toni Morrison seems very recent, and of course she was just with us, but what she was doing was still not welcome. And it's still, you can see that in the plethora of interviews that we watch with her, where somebody is always trying to take hold of her and shift the perspective and shift the narrative into something that's familiar to them and something that allows them to continue being the center of the universe. So like, I will both say that what I do and how I do it was inevitable and it wasn't going to be stopped, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't fed and it wasn't encouraged. And the reason it was inevitable to me was because people were before me, because people were already doing it. I don't need to be the token of anything. So looking at stuff like I remember the first time I encountered Toni Morrison, which was actually in high school, thank God. I wish it'd been earlier, but I'm very pleased to have been able to study it in a very serious IB English 4 class, where we were trained and taught to look on it with reverence, to approach it with our brains on and understanding how serious her literature was. Because I was only one of maybe one Black students in that class. So to learn it in a context of like, everyone needs to understand how important this is, was like, I'm here for it. It was very dope. And also that particular teacher, Mr. Guy Roberts, identifying that I understood some of the intricacies that the other students weren't. And he literally asked me, he was like, do you want to come up here and explain this when we got to something? I was like, sure. And so that understanding that I had, that she was writing to me, and that I did have a closeness to her work that allowed me some insight that the rest of my classmates could benefit from. That entire experience was amazing. But when I read her voice and I heard her voice, something that had been said to me a lot of times was, you have such a classic voice, you have such a classical voice. And you can write authentically, you can write in your own voice. And I was like, this is my natural voice, like, what are you talking about? So when I read Toni Morrison for the first time, it was like, no, that's her natural voice too. I'm not crazy. Like, you're trying to force me to be different than I am. And I'm coming into contact with somebody who, this is who she is. This is how her voice comes out. This is what her prose sounds like. And she doesn't make any attempt to dialecticize it or make it something that's more palatable to you, particularly given the fact that her books are almost entirely, with the exception maybe of Paradise, peopled with Black people. And yet this prose is so, I mean, it has that sort of James Baldwin misleading simplicity on a sentence level, where the undertow is so strong that you're overwhelmed before you realize what's happening. Like, that kind of clean, beautiful, again, misleadingly simple but extremely intricate prose. And I loved that, and I was always drawn to that. But I do definitely remember people trying to give me quote unquote permission to talk like myself, quote unquote. I was in Christian school, I was in private schools, I was in special programs, and I distinctly remember a teacher also, you know, asking my dad if he was writing my papers for me. So that's just good old fashioned anti-Blackness. But so I remember that moment. But before that, my dad had gotten really, really fixated on Terry McMillan's Waiting to Exhale. And so he went out and bought every single one of her books. And so I, with these Costco cinnamon, cinnamon cookies, I read all of the books that he bought. I remember my favorite one was Mama. I remember reading Disappearing Acts. I mean, I have actual olfactory and sort of like sensory memories associated with reading those books, because I always had like a snack while I was reading it. And absolutely was not written for 12, 13, 14 year old. But it was a Black woman writing about the everyday lives of Black people. And again, somebody doing that like it's just something you can do, allowed it to be inevitable to me, instead of feeling like I must write for Black people. Somebody was already writing for Black people. Not enough somebodies were breaking through, but somebody was always writing for Black people. So I didn't have to feel like there was this great burden on me to be the one to put, like, come on, mm-hmm. like we've been doing this.
Because the expectation, I think, a lot of times I encounter it doing this, mm-hmm. we have to do so many other things that aren't really what we're doing per se. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've heard can you use your real voice? It's like,
this is it.
The thing that I do. Or right. where did that accent come from? You're not from Baltimore, right? It's like, I'm from East Baltimore. I've been here all 39 years. What are you saying to me? And, you know, and now granted, sometimes it is the homies in the community might say, sometimes I butch it up a little bit more, but mm-hmm. my voice is my voice.
Right.
And my interests are my interests. And you know, sort of my references are my references. This makes me up as an individual. And I used to do a podcast, and if I still have it on a drive, I'll share it with you because I think you might find it interesting. I did it with one of my buddies. He's a safe beige, as I call it, light skinned brother. And we had this podcast called Unofficially Black, and we would do things like just as real, just black dudes. Mm-hmm. And we would get told often by folks that are more black than us.
Yeah.
That ain't black. It's like, I'm black and I'm doing it.
Well, there you go. Listen,
what you saying though?
let me teach you how to interrogate yourself too, because people have this idea that every black person is a walking sociologist, is walking with a PhD in social science and all that kind of stuff. And the issue is white supremacy is relentless. It destroys white people and it absolutely turns black people inside out. So the difference, of course, being I can have grace with the person who's not intentionally feeding me the poison. So with black people, it's just, hey, I want you to interrogate the smallness of your own self-definition and who benefits from you having that small definition and who instilled that small definition in you. So, you know, so a lot of times with black people, it's just like you said, well, I'm black and I'm doing it right. Mm-hmm. All right. So that should be the end of that conversation.
I love it. Look, that's going to be a caption. That's just like...
Right.
So, let's see. Let me see what I have left here. Cause I have like, definitely I got a few like specific and then, you know, a couple about Awesome Con. So I'll move into more of the specific. So you're known for doing a lot of interesting work.
I like that. Put the sentence right there. You're known for doing a lot.
but you know, you see sort of the, you know, best-selling author and adult and in young adult novels. Are there different considerations that are made based on the audience? Is it sort of like, I think this fits more in sort of towards this audience versus this? What are your considerations when you're putting together work, when you're writing, that as it relates to an audience?
I like that question because I do think that it's important for people to understand, for me, and I'm not speaking about being an author of young adult and adult. I'm talking about being Bethany C. Morrow as a young adult and adult author. For me, my natural voice, my natural home is adult. Mm-hmm. And it's adult. I used to say speculative literary, and now I will say something has to function like a speculative element. And I found that horror does that. I found that historical does that. But something has to function like a speculative device. So that's my natural place. When I think of stories, when stories come to me, they are default to the adult audience, blah, blah. And the only time that they're not is when it's something to edify a young black person. That's an intentionality. Like, that is saying, I am not simply crafting a story. I'm not only being true and authentic to a concept, a character, and a construct, which are my three C's always of writing. But when it's for young adult, it's because I have something to give them, hopefully. With Song Below Water, it's very much about giving language, because a lot of black kids, of course, we have to have a wisdom, unfortunately, that surpasses our years. The adultification of black kids is not a myth. When you're constantly facing microaggressions, and I just want to remind the audience, microaggression doesn't mean small. It's micro versus macro. It means it's a microcosm of what you're seeing on a macro scale. It's a systemic assault. So it's not a small infraction. It's a microcosm of the macro infraction that's ongoing. But they don't always, and usually they know it when they see it, but that doesn't mean they know how to defend themselves. And it doesn't mean that they know what to make of it. And it doesn't mean that they have the fortitude to resist the drive and sort of the requirement to believe the lie and to put themselves second. And when I'm writing for young adult, it's because I'm hopefully edifying that particular population. It has an active desired outcome, which adult does not have for me. It's no less rewarding, and it's no less, but it's a responsibility that I take seriously. And I don't do it lightly. So if people are wondering why I can say there's a chance I won't ever write any more young adult, it's because the reason that I write young adult is quite specific. And unless I feel that I can do something necessary or something essential and craft a beautiful story and work with, you know, with my craft at a certain level, then I personally am not drawn to do it. There are certain people who every story they come up with is young adult, and that's just what they write and where they write it, and it's no deeper or shallower than that, and that's fine, but that's not me. So three back to back gave people the impression that I was just Brighton young. I'm like, no, I was doing something specific with each of those. And obviously starting with my anthology, and my short story that I contributed to the anthology that I edited, all of that was for a very intentional purpose. Because there's a need and they're deserving, and I'm not going to watch an entire generation be gaslit into thinking this country has made more headway and is giving them more liberty than it actually is.
I mean, I'm over here going through and I'm like, so, you know, we got to give you your points or what have you. I mean, look, 20, like NPR, best book of the year. Come on, let's slap it up. Let's be real. I that's a really well thought out answer. And I really, really appreciate you giving us that extra context and flourish, because it is a thing. Like, you know, I could just do this, you know, with no consideration, no extra thought. And it's just like, well, that doesn't come natural to me. What does come natural to me? And really thinking about that into that consideration. And the other thing that you did in that answer, which I really appreciate, is you make my job a little easier. You kind of like one of my later questions already. So I was like, so much appreciated there. So I want to ask about, because I keep seeing sort of it's a small book with big ideas. So I got to ask about Mem a little bit. So what was the sort of genesis around, and I hate that word, but I'm going to use it here. Mm-hmm. What was the genesis, like the sort of that initial spark? And I know that everything is inevitable. I'm titling this The Inevitable Bethany Seymour, but what was the sort of genesis around, like around Mem or what have you? Because I'm very curious around like memory and identity. And whenever I see any sort of media that's around memory, because look, the moment that I can't remember things and I have an elephant like memory, I guess that's a thing. Right. When I start losing my memory, I was like, look, mm-mm. So right. I want to hear some of those thoughts.
Oh, absolutely. So Mem, I am I remain so pleased that is my debut, because if you want to know who I am as an artist, that is the greatest encapsulation. It's a speculative literary novella with a historical element that has so much to do with misogynoir, with anti-blackness, with what it means to love across those lines and how far you go to honor somebody else's understanding before you must insist on the truth and insist on your own. And I probably have never even described it that way before, but you know, it's a book because it continues to be relevant and continues to be talked about. I continue to be asked about it. I get the opportunity to keep considering it, over and over again, which I very much appreciate. But that book, I had written two young adult science fiction manuscripts back to back, and I am always thinking, as soon as I know everything there is to know about a story, I am thinking, where am I going? What am I writing next? What's the next? I have to have something that my brain is using as a background program, and I wanted to go home basically because I was a little exhausted. So for me, again, if I'm exhausted, I'm going to go to the literary section, and hopefully there's no such thing really in bookstores as the speculative literary section. So you got to just know what you're looking for. But I'm going to go to a Colson Whitehead's Zone One or anything by James Baldwin is good enough for me. Or, you know, you're just returning to, let's say, for me, if I was going to say, like, to me, this is very much is speculative literary, but Octavia Butler's Speech Sounds, the short story in Blood Child, that's where I go home. And when I know that the concept is where stuff starts for me. So I was literally laying down for a nap on August 5th, 2011. I know this because I got so tired of not remembering exactly when something started that I wrote it down. Cause like I said, I'm a journaler. and I was thinking of how sad it is that science fiction is not as, or science is not as interesting as science fiction to me. And my lived experience example of that was Dolly the sheep. When I was in elementary school, the cloning of Dolly was a huge conversation. We were constantly talking about it. We're listening to updates about it. And of course, I am a child in a Star Trek household. So I'm thinking that, like, oh my gosh, they're about to bring out an equal size and aged sheep to show us that they successfully cloned something. And then it's like, here's an embryo. And I'm like, wait, what? That's just a genetic twin. Like, what are you, that's not a clone. So I was like, what makes a clone? Oh, by the way, just shout out to Multiplicity. By the way, I was obsessed with that movie when I was
nice.
Love you, Michael Keaton, forever. but like, I was very upset. As a kid, I felt betrayed. I was like, this is wrong. These are liars. Adults are liars. So, you know, in 2011, I was like, what is it to me that constitutes a clone then? And for me, it's about identity. You have to be, a clone must be the same person. It can have markedly different, just like, you know, flapping of a butterfly's wings. You can have the same person go a couple of different ways to great effect and great difference for sure. But the foundation has to be the same. We have to start as one thing. And then if we diverge, we diverge. But because I'm a speculative writer, it was like, okay, so what if cloning was only about memory? What if the purpose of cloning was to save memories? And then, you know, if I can, I try to make things unsettling. So it's like, well, what if cloning was simply a byproduct of trying to get rid of memories? Like, if it was, and that's what Mem is. Mem is a book about a alternate history, Montreal in the 1920s, although the story sort of starts in the early 1900s, in which scientists have devised a way to extract unwanted memories. And because of the gravity, really, of memories and what they are and how important and integral they are, to do so is to create an entity all its own, which is a mem, obviously short for memory. And these mems are really just keepsakes. They just house this one particular memory until it expires, basically, until it runs out. But the source, the human who had oh gosh, I love when I just drop words and make myself sound super intelligent. The person who had the procedure done is called the source. And once the mem has been extracted, they no longer have access to that memory. They don't remember that memory. And as in capitalistic societies, yes, it started out because we want to extract unwanted memories. But when we realized that there was a possible entertainment aspect to this, which is that these mems, the only thing that they should be able to do is to relive and recite the original memory. So, okay, maybe I'll take out a memory that I actually do like because I can have it perform. I can, you know, they can do live performances and readings and that sort of thing. And obviously, because it's a capitalistic society, the only people who really have access to this technology, of course, are the wealthy. And so the difference occurs and the problem occurs when the first mem of a woman named Dolores, which means that this mem's first name, her initial name is Dolores Extract Number One. She is not operating like a mem. She does not fit the description of a mem. She knows that she's alive. She knows how long she's been alive. She has all of the memories preceding the memory for which she was extracted, and she creates memories after she was extracted. And so she begins with a bit of celebrity, of course, because it's like, this is a mem that can do something that no mem can do. And then at the start of the book, we are following her as she's being recalled back to the vault, which is sort of this underground dormitory where mems live and die, live and expire. And because she's been allowed to live out in the outside world, and because she's had this kind of celebrity, and because she obviously does not seem to be a mem, she seems to be a person, how far is this going to go? And who decides whether she has the right to her own life? And that's mem.
I mean, look. I'm sitting here I'll put it this way before I move into this last real question, awesome con question. Whenever I'm hearing sort of like, you can get sort of the story, but when you're hearing it from the author, you're getting the flourish. And I'm sitting here like my science fiction mind is like salivating. It's like, because I see like other, and I'm not going to do that thing of like, yeah, you know, this reminds me of this, because that's not, but it definitely gives me that feeling of the sort of inner sci-fi guy that is like, oh, sure. Like, I'm a Philip K. Dick guy. I would just sit there, and I used to work at a Catholic college. I would just sit there in a library. I was like, there's something weird about what I'm doing right now, reading like sci-fi in a Catholic institution. I was like, but I break rules. This is what we're doing. And just going through it. And I used to be one of those people that would get frustrated because I read slowly. And I'm like, nah, I need to change it. Like, I'm always tinkering, right? It's like, the way I can do it is just audiobook. I'm an audio guy. It's like,
yeah.
Blowing through, consuming it, and then I can make those references. And I don't know, I start seeing things in that. And I'd just say random things just to people, just to see like people I work with that know me. I'm like, yeah, where's my electric car? Where's my flying car? It's like, are you reading Philip K. Dick? It's like, don't worry about that.
Don't worry about what I be doing.
Where's my stuff? It's great. All right. So this is sort of the last question. And one of the reasons we got connected, and I'm so excited and happy that we did get connected, because it goes, it transcends this. It goes past this. But one of the things that's coming up is AwesomeCon, DC's Comic-Con. Can you share, like, you know, what you're looking forward to? Have you been before? What are you looking forward to? You know,
I was there last year, not as an author, despite the fact that they tried to rope me into sitting down and like signing, because I was there as a friend of loyalty, the bookstore, my beloved Hannah's bookstore. So I was just there for that reason, and obviously to buy stuff. But then I did Rose City Comic Con last year, which is in Portland, which I absolutely loved. It was absolutely amazing. And so the group that organizes both of these then reached out and asked me to do AwesomeCon. And then obviously, you know, my friend's bookstore is the bookstore of it. So Christina lets me know, like, I told them that they needed to get you to come, because I had like refused to do it last year. Cause I was like, I'm here to have fun. I'm sorry. I'm not at work. So I'm looking forward to being there for work. I'm looking forward to being on panels. I'm looking forward to, you know, speaking to and actually signing for readers. Rose City was amazing because we did not, the bookstore, and shout out to Sean Speakman, love him and his family. He was operating the bookstore for Rose City, and they weren't able to get mem. And obviously at a Comic-Con, somebody while I'm on panel is going to bring up mem and is going to ask me questions about it. And so there were a bunch of people that was like, really? Seriously? Like, this book is not available? So on it must have been the third day, somebody comes back having gone to Powell's and gotten mem and brought it back to the con for me to sign, because they're like, I was not going to not get this one. I love speculative readers. I love the conversations. I love the questions. So I am so looking forward to it. I literally got to see both Rogue and Gambit last year, which is me and my husband's alter ego. So I was like, we took pictures with them. It was amazing. So we are Rogue and Gambit. So I'm, as you can hear, I'm an idiot dork, and I'm very much looking forward to it. I do have to do a plug really quickly because you just now said you're into audiobooks. We are talking about sci-fi. We're talking about especially the blackness of science fiction and ancestral magic and all that kind of stuff and sci-fantasy. My girl, Ella McKinney, who you probably know as the author of Blade So Black and also the author of the Nubia Real One graphic novel that I believe won the, oh gosh, let me not say the wrong thing. Is it the Eisner? And then she's got two more books coming in that. She's the one who kind of rebooted Nubia for DC in the, I think it's the Future States comics that they were doing. Yes. Anyway, so LL and I were asked by Realm to do an original audio drama called Morning Glory, which then was purchased by Spotify and they turned it into an audio book. And that is currently out. So you have to get into Morning Glory. It is about a sister set. Really, it's three sisters and a first cousin because it's going to be blackety black. Okay. Cousins are siblings too. All right. And they are a part of a black family that has the last black funeral parlor in the area. And they also, you know, they have this ancestral matrilineal magic and it helps the community keep boo hags and such in line. But there's been sort of their family has had this legion after them since the time of their ancestor Glory. And the magic has always passed to the daughter, the next daughter of that woman. And there's only ever been one daughter. And now, of course, this generation, there's three daughters. Stuff is going wrong. Legion is coming. And it was just such a blast. And audio drama for me was like, oh, I could do this every day. Like having an audio production, basically make your script sound like a movie. I was not ready when Legion started talking. When the demon voice started, we listened to it together. We were jumping. It was like, okay, all right. Oh, you're gonna score my scenes as well? You're gonna hit the emotional notes? It is everything. So if you haven't listened to Morning Glory, you absolutely need to listen to it.
It's funny you mention it. I just subscribed on Spotify because I do them Spotify Premium, and I definitely had it up on your website too. So I was like,
yes.
What is this? I'm picking up what you're putting down, sister.
Yes, it is. I love it so much. Hopefully, we will be asked to do a second season because we have in mind stories for a second season. So we will see.
I mean, if you ever need a giant podcast personality,
listen.
Look, I'm just saying.
Look, we've met now. We've connected now. So,
all right. So I got, and thank you for that. And we also we do the shameless plugs at the very end as well. So definitely tap back on at the end. So this is the last couple of things I want to do real quick. And thank you for giving me that sort of feedback around like Awesome Con, because, you know, I enjoy the cons. And like I said, before we got started, I've had a relationship with the con over the last like number of years. And it's truly a great experience to go there. I'm not just saying that as a person that's working with them. It's like I've gone beforehand, even before this relationship. And yeah. It's great. You know, I go so there. Great. I always like bring other people. I'm like, hey, you know, you should go to Awesome Con, right? Yeah. And it's that. It's just like I like being around fanboys, fangirls, fan everyone's.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, having like you said, you and your husband are Gambit and Rogue will have you. And you know, being my partner. I don't know who she looks like a Bratz doll. Like that's just what her aesthetic is. It's just,
oh, come on.
My hair is pink and I'm this. And I'm like, I'm an ogre. I don't know what to tell you. And I was like, I don't know where this goes.
I mean, I kind of love that. I ship that. An ogre and a Bratz doll? Hell yeah.
But so here's the rapid fire questions I got for Awesome Con. Because I think, or rapid fire questions I have generally, but the first one is for Awesome Con. And I think that, you know, especially when you're working, as you were touching on, that it can be long days. So this is the first question I got for you. Coffee or tea on Awesome Con morning? What do you anticipate for yourself?
That is hilarious. Do I get to say neither for rapid fire? Because I don't drink coffee. And I don't. And I don't have a story of coffee killing my father, you guys. I just don't like, I just don't drink coffee. It smells amazing though. So you can keep carrying it around me. I promise it'll be in ice water in the morning.
Okay. I can't knock it. I mean, I'm a coffee snob. So next question is going to be, so what you taking your coffee?
That's amazing. And you will be happy to know that I can't disappoint you because there is no coffee. So I will have a watermelon hint water. All right. It's flat water with no sweeteners infused with watermelon essence. That's what I will have.
See, when I'm drinking water, which I do drink water. I'm not one of those people like, I don't touch the stuff.
Your kidneys and your organs, hope you're not saying that.
as my partner's kid would say, yo, why you drink spicy water? I love Topo Chico. I love just regular Topo Chico. Just, it's just something extra in there.
It's nice when it's nice. But like living outside of the United States and always having to say flat water, if I ask for water, I need your default to be spring water, guys. I need you to not be coming over here with the spice when I just asked for water. I'm so tired of it, Europe. I'm tired of it. I need you to do better. Water is flat.
That's a good answer. All right. See, this one is a softball, and I'm going to save the funny one that I added while you were talking earlier, because I had a good question. I was like, I got to ask you that. So here's this next one. If you could have any superpower, what would it be? It's kind of but
this is so difficult. And I'm the type of person, if you ask me what my favorite is, you're going to get favorite today. Okay. And it's the same way with superpowers. You asked me for what superpower is going to be today. Right now it would be teleportation, because I don't actually like flying until I'm actually next to the clouds. In which case I'm like, oh, this is the purpose of flying. I get to be near my clouds. But other than that, I don't like flying. And so I would absolutely love, and as somebody who likes to go places, would love teleportation, as long as I could grab somebody and, of course, thereby take them with me. We don't need to talk about the science of that. Just understand that that's how my superpower works.
That's a great answer. I like the thoughtfulness in that answer. You know how in Daredevil, how he's the man without fear, what have you? Mm-hmm. I want to be the man without failure. That's not quite a superpower like his, you know, not being fearful of anything.
Yes, listen, my speculative literary mind has an immediate reaction to that of, are you sure? I think you're underestimating the necessity of failure in development and growth. Are we sure?
This is what happens. I have a sense of what it is. As an Aquarius, right? I'm an Aquarius, so I always need someone to rein in my BS. And that was
are we sure we want to take failure out of the equation, beloved? I'm gonna ask you to meditate on that.
it's like that meme. It's like, you sure about that? All right, this is the last one. So you're mentioning earlier about your dad's books and, you know, sort of Toni Morrison? No.
Terry McMillan. My dad's obsession with Terry McMillan, yeah.
And I notice a snack sort of accompaniment with it. So, you know, if you were to make a suggestion for one of your works, mm-hmm. what would be the accompanying snack with it? So it's like, hey, you should read this, but also you should probably have an ice cream. What's the snack combination for one of your works?
I sort of like fundamentally forgot food existed in my work. Just same way as if you come into my work and you're like, give me a detailed, I've had editors be like, can you please just describe one person? And I'm like, no. but other than hair, for the young Black girls, I will give you all of the Black hair love. And just, you know, I completely geek out over Black girls' hair. But the interesting thing that began to happen is that supper book clubs began to choose my book, Mem, which is so interesting because there is a marked lack of food in that book. And the only real thing that I even put in there was for the express purpose of being like, remember when y'all ate nasty shit? So the thing that Nurse Nettie and Elsie, which is the name that Dolores Extract Number One chooses for herself, the thing that they eat is Neapolitan and custard which is the kind of grossest but most common thing I could find to think about, like, because we used to have this 1950s Betty Crocker cookbook, and it was just an assault on the senses, just the pictures, and it was really just an anthropological study in, like, in white people, just like so much creativity and so little taste. So you know, just because you put something in a gelatin tin does not make it edible. All right. So this is such a hilarious question to ask me, because I could tell you what people have chosen to pair with my work, which I'm like, good for you. Elsie loves going to the movies. And so they always do some sort of like, very elevated popcorn type thing, which I love. I'm like, you know, do you? Somebody did a deviled egg recipe for me. I have no idea where they took that inspiration. There are no deviled eggs in that book. When they explained it to me, I remember being like, oh, I see that. I don't see it anymore. It had to be the moment.
I don't have a memory of seeing that.
I don't have a memory of seeing it. In A Song Below Water, I know that they're eating a particular kind of sandwich that I just remember from the West Coast. I remember liking it. It had alfalfa sprouts on it, and you know, it had avocado on it, and it had a multi-grain bread and stuff that sounded really good. But honestly, I so infrequently, until let's say like So Many Beginnings, because, oh, you know what? There's quite a bit of food. Well, no, let me say there's two scenes with food to cherish, Vera. So Many Beginnings, the point of that was, of course, it's a historical, and we're on Roanoke Island during wartime, and we're talking about what's available and not available, you know, what we would have been eating because the Civil War is ongoing. They do make a molasses apple pie. They eat shad fish, which is like known to be ridiculously bony, and so it's a very embarrassing fish to serve and eat in front of a new person, which they do sort of at the beginning of that book. But listen, whatever you find is probably going to be much more palatable, because when I encounter food, or when I think of food, 50% of the time at least, it's a troll. So like, I'm just like, I would not go to my books for cookbooks, all right? Like, let me direct you to the Skyrim cookbook, and that will probably be more appetizing. Yeah, there's barbecue and burgers and stuff and coleslaw in Cherish Farah, and there is my favorite sort of like pasta, but I don't eat a lot of pasta, so it's one that I particularly like, with ricotta and whatever. But yeah, I'm. Me talking like this actually makes it sound like there's more food in my books than there is. Whatever you find to eat while you're reading my book is probably fine.
I love it. I love it.
That was the longest.
Hey, look, I prefer the honesty. I like it. Like, you know, I had one of those, you know, like, again, as I was saying earlier, my science fiction inner, I was going to say something very different, but my science fiction thing was tickled. I was putting that in. And when you mentioned like molasses, apple, what? I was just like, say more. I didn't want to.
Yeah, that is one thing that, and when my editor, when she sent me the past pages, she sent me molasses apple pie cookies. She basically found or concocted a recipe. And I was like, if my reward for actually occasionally including something that sounds good is that somebody makes it for me, I'm like, I could deal with that. I loved that. Shout out to Emily Settle for sending me them cookies.
That's a great way to end it and close out. And thank you. This has been delicious at the end. I'll say that. but this has been very, very robust, very, very rewarding. I feel like I've gotten smarter in this interview, which is
hilarious.
It's great. And
it'll wear off. You're gonna find out in about 5 minutes that it's all an elaborate ruse, and
just gonna drink some Topo Chico and just like, oh, right. Yeah,
spicy water to wake you right back up. She did.
Bethany was right. This spicy water's gotta go. I need flat. Flat is where the intellect is at.
Yes.
With that, I want to do two things. I want to, one, thank you for coming on and making the time to chat about your work and, you know, kind of give us a little bit of a primer for AwesomeCon. And two, I want to invite and encourage you to, you know, let us know, you know, sort of that shameless plug, you know, like social media, website, any projects that are coming up that you want to share in the final moments. The floor is yours.
Absolutely. Well, as I like to tell people, I would really appreciate if y'all would eat what's already on the table. Listen, I'm always, and I came out with three books in the course of like 9 months in 2021 and 2022, and it had people thinking that what I was trying to get them to do was constantly ask me about what's next. And I was like, beloved, don't be greedy, eat what's on the table. So again, I write adult and young adult, ranging from contemporary fantasy to speculative literary to historical to social horror, which is what Cherish Fair is. I did this amazing horror fantasy, Morning Glory, that Spotify has released, that I co-wrote with LL McKinney. I would love for you to engage with any and all of it. You can pre-order my books through Loyalty. If you are coming to AwesomeCon for me to sign, I will be on multiple panels over that weekend. I think I have a panel every day at AwesomeCon, so would love to meet people and sign books, because I cannot guarantee which ones they will actually have on site. So if you want to make sure that there's one of them that you get, and you can go to BethanyCMorrow.com, my website, to see kind of a refresher on what all of my titles are. I also have the award-winning anthology. It was the 2020 ILA Social Justice and Literature Award winner, Take the Mic, for which I was the editor and the contributor. I wrote my marching band short story in there that I'm very happy about. I cannot believe it took me that long to write about marching band. But I'm just excited to meet people at AwesomeCon.
That was dope. Thank you. And definitely follow through, folks. You know, get those books, get those signed things. You never know what's going to be there. You already had that experience you were touching on earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm out here looking at my my situation, too. I got to do my loyalty situation, too, because I need to have something on hand, you know.
You got to make sure you have what you want, because things move quickly at cons. And I will sign books that you bring from the outside also. So, I mean, nobody ever needs that reminder, because they always bring something anyway.
Here's my journal. I'm also a journaler. Here's my journal. Can you sign it? You know?
Absolutely. And yes, I can.
And there you have it, folks. I want to again thank Bethany C. Morrow for coming on and sharing a bit of her journey with us. And big shout out to AwesomeCon for helping bring this together. And I am your host, Rob Lee, saying that there's art, culture, and community in and around your neck of the woods. You've just got to look for it.